be blue, 'cause I can't see you. Richie, I love you.
Hey, welcome to Vintage Anal's Archive Outsider Podcast with your host, Richie Wexler. We are at 59, episode 59. This is our second year into it, about four or five, six episodes in. Very excited to be doing another season. This is a whole kind of different ball game, in my opinion. We've really worked a lot harder at inclusivity. We've found amazing women to talk to that just blew my mind. I just feel like things are going in a direction of more, again, inclusivity that I've been trying to get to for a while, and it has to be natural, and it takes a while, you know? We're not throwing people in as tokens. It takes relationships to build this kind of stuff, and we're finally getting there. It took a long time. Anyway, Ricky Tucker is a writer, educator, and a culture critic based in New York City. His work explores the imprints of art and memory on narrative and the absurdity of the most fleeting moments. He's written for the Paris Review, 10th Magazine, Literary Hub, and Public Seminar, among others, and has performed for reading series including The Moth, Grand Slam, Sister Spit, Born Free, and Spark London. Connect with him at therickytucker.com. Today we're going to talk about the book and the category is Inside New York's Vogue House and Ballroom Community, written by Ricky Tucker. It's a love letter to the legendary Black and Latinx LGBTQ underground subculture, uncovering its abundant legacy and influence in popular culture. What is ballroom? Not a song, a documentary, a catchphrase, a TV show, or an individual pop star. It's an underground subculture founded over a century ago by LGBTQ, African-American, and Latino men and women of Harlem. Art-based and intersectional, it transcends identity, acting as a fearless response to the systemic marginalization of minority populations. Joining me today, speaking with Ricky, is icon Ebony Fierce, Philadelphia musician, born performance artist. They have one mission: to change people's perception of artistic expression one subculture at a time. Icon has a background in theater, dance, spoken word, performance since 2003. They also specialize in hosting, emceeing, burlesque, performance art, and drag since 2012. Their content includes sexuality, body positivity, political, social issues, gender equality, etc. They are also a curator for festivals like Freakin' Queer, Hot Bits Film Fest, and more. They're just a sweetheart. I've known them for years, and they just make the community a better place. Always with a smile, always with an amazing performance, always using their talents with activism to change the lives of other people that you know had to fight harder than them. A true human, true sweetheart of a human being. So enjoy.
Ricky Tucker. I'm a writer, and I teach writing too. And I wrote a book about ball culture in New York City, the place where it debatably started, but the most prominent spot. And it's a book called "And the Category Is Inside New York's Vogue House and Ballroom Community." And someone who I've talked to before, Mackenzie Wark, who is another author who teaches at the New Schools, called it an embodiment of ball culture, which I think is good because I'm not a journalist technically. I'm a creative writer, so I write about arts and personal narrative and politics within that. And so I'm not a journalist. I don't know how to do that. It sounds real boring. And I'm not an anthropologist, because that would also be horrible. And I wouldn't call it an ethnography or an autoethnography, because again, that's too technical. So it's sort of, and I knew when I wrote the book, I wanted it to be in conjunction with the community that I know and love. So every essay that I wrote for the book has an interview, at least one interview at the end or incorporated into the story. And there's a lot of art criticism in there, because that's sort of where I shined. That's the book. And it was unbeknownst to me, 10 years of research. I didn't know I was going to write this book, but I got 2 degrees in writing in the meantime. And then the opportunity came and I was like, duh, obviously I'm supposed to write this. So
this had started through you taking the Vogueology course, correct?
Yeah. My love affair with ballroom was before that, but that led me to taking the class, which was the first class I took at the new school as an undergrad. And then I met the community, and then I met both my gay fathers, and on and on and on and on. Cut to 12 years later, and here we are today.
So, I mean, if you just want to kind of get, you know, I know you do a lot of, I know some of the world you live in, not all. I know you get involved with advocacy, politics, health, performing, you know, leadership. So, I mean.
I'm Ebony, Ebony Alley. I'm also known as Icon Ebony Fierce. I'm a drag performer in Philadelphia. And like producer and curator in Philadelphia, and I'm also a program manager at a QT BIPOC radical social justice organization called Galay here in North Philadelphia. I do a little bit of this and that, working with youth and providing services in a more radical way for Black and Latinx communities in Philadelphia, but I'm also an MC and drag performer in Philly. I have a lot of lovely friends that's in the ballroom scene or have been previously in the ballroom scene that are some of my drag daughters. So I have like quite a lot of knowledge about it.
It's like a Venn diagram, isn't it?
It's like, yeah, it is. It's like, it's all interconnected.
Or like a Chanel logo.
Yes.
Ebony, how'd you get into drag? What led you there?
So drag for me started, I've always been fascinated by playing around with like gender expression, and like going on YouTube is finding people from ballroom, also club K culture. Yeah. And been always fascinated about that, but I didn't really have access to do that. So I kind of found some underground like events and parties where I would just like dress up a little bit. And I started emceeing those parties, which was a little bit more of a mixed kind of a environment. But I found out about a local bar here called Taboo. That had a benefit for someone's top surgery. And at the time I, did not really have a wealth of knowledge about like trans surgeries or like trans folks and culture in general, where I actually came. know a little bit more about myself. But I met a lot of drag performers there. And I was like, oh wow, so how do you get into this? How do you get into that? And they kind of led me into like the directions of different performers and community members. And I just went on from there.
YouTube is interesting because I in the book, I kind of talk about the gateway drugs to ballroom. And one of them is like down here is like the Piers, like the Chelsea Piers. Like if you are young and gay and walk by there and see someone voguing, they got you, right? And then YouTube, like watching people vogue on YouTube is like this gateway point where, and so I don't know if YouTube knows that, if it's responsible for everybody coming out and hitting scenes and stuff, but it really is. Like, I mean, aside from the entirety of Paris is Burning being on YouTube, right? And which is funny too, because on the other end, it's one of the most successful documentaries of all time and on Criterion, but then also free for the kids, which is great. YouTube is very, very, it's very, very interesting. And everything that you just explained sounds like almost the exact same thing that I've heard from other folks too.
Yeah, one of those things, one of the things I found online and on YouTube was Paris is Burning. And this is before it kind of, I guess at the time, a lot of people didn't really know about it as much as they do now. It was kind of like, oh, this is just random video or documentary that was easily searchable. I was like, what is this?
Right. Isn't it captivating when you first see it? Like, it's this feeling of, stop the record. What is this? / There it is. You know what I mean? Obviously, this has to exist. And I kind of knew it, but here we are, right?
It's one of my top five favorite documentaries. And at the time, I knew nothing about that world. It's just such a unique and intimate portrait of that community, and it's so well done.
Captivating.
Absolutely. The time I found it too, it was like when I was in high school in like the late 2000s, and I was like, okay, and I'm like, yes, this is where people are getting like a lot of like the lingo in the language. Yes. Like when you was like go and watch the Tyra Banks show or America's Best Top Model or, or other things like that, you're just like, yes, honey, tea, blah blah blah.
But I like how both of your examples were like Tyra. Like, but she's the one, yeah. Which also not for nothing, that format is Drag Race, right? Like that's the exact same format. Yeah.
Drag Race, yep, it's that too.
One of the things in the book, real quick, that I thought was interesting is, I'm not sure when, I think it was an interview where you talk about like, why is the key to be famous? Why is the key not to just do this for your community? And I think that's important. So I wonder if here is a good place to kind of talk about, you know, Drag Race versus Tyra Banks, but then versus like performing in the community and what you're doing on YouTube. I'm wondering if this might be a place to bring in that a conversation around why it, essentially answering, why is it that everybody just wants to be so big? And then, I mean, not everybody, but why is there a dynamic where some people are just happy to do the art form and why some people need to like, it's only good if a bigger audience is seeing me. And I'm curious if you can discuss that for a minute.
So for where I stand, there's a distinction between wanting fame and wanting to be seen. And wanting to be seen automatically dictates who's your audience. And so in ballroom, this is folks who are commonly unseen by the greater culture wanting to be seen by their own, right? So that's just a start. Like you want to be in a safe space with other folks who are queer, people of color, and you want to be known for being fabulous or amazing or stand out, right? I mean, literally you get a trophy, right? And so so that's one end of it. But then now that it's, I don't want to say now because it really is like a recurring thing, like ballroom has been popularized for like 100 years, right? Like I call it an exponential series of peaks and valleys. Like it's going up, right? But it's not like Madonna happens, then Pose happens, then, you know, so it's always something. But people forget, pop culture forgets, that's how it thrives, right? So it forgets and then it remembers all of a sudden. So now that it's fairly popularized, the question is like, should people be commodifying it, right? Or, and then if so, how should you? Like there's these moral and capitalistic implications that keep coming in and out. My inclination is, well, isn't that a convenient question to ask folks who are economically and socially marginalized why they need money? Like why does anybody else need it? Like, of course I make a living by my art. You know, like that's like asking me why I teach writing and write for a living. It's like, it's my passion, I'm good at it, and I want to serve, you know, whether that be like serving by getting all 10s or serving a or the greater community. Like it seems, I mean, and this is, I'm not criticizing your question, it's just like after answering that question for so long, it's just like obviously people want to make a living by what they do. And I asked Twiggy, who choreographed Runway Walking for Pose and who's like my gay sister. And Twiggy was like, I've been in ballroom since I was like a teenager. And, you know, I used to be like, I want to be able to put ballroom on my resume. And everyone was like, you can't do that. And now she can.
Yeah.
Just like with drag, right? Like, I mean, at certain points, you only could get tips, right?
Exactly. Now, like drag, like as soon as you speak on that, now, like, you know, I remember when I started drag, it was still like a very under the table thing. Although it was like on TV and people have been making money drag for decades. But I'm in Philly, so it's not the same as like when you're doing drag in New York. You're like.
Right. But they're sisters, though.
Yeah, it's like not the same. It's like still under the table, you're at a club bar setting. But now, like, you know, you can. Now I get a W-9 form to do a gig. You know, I travel, and then, you know, you could. There's a whole network of people. It's like more involved now, and it's more mainstream. And you know, people are getting paid millions of dollars to do this now.
Yeah, which presents a whole other set of issues, right?
Yeah.
And to go back to your question, Rich, it's like then you have to question sort of like, what is the difference between performing for my folks and performing for the example that just comes to mind because I've watched with Trixie and Katya, like, yeah, and they always talk about the difference between performing for like the gays and then performing for a bridal shower for Miss Karen, and like so the song choices are different, the way the jokes are different, you don't want to scare anybody too much, so you can't get too great, like, but then your people is like you're cutting up and stuff, so like I think it just becomes, it's, you know, I don't think you have to choose one or the other, but there will be some choices made for you in your curation of that, I would say. And a ball made for Becky and them is not fun. No, I don't, that's not a ball. That's a ballroom workshop. Like it's not going to a ball, right?
I'll be the one person to point out that white people ruin everything, considering I consider myself at least half Jewish, but you know, half white. I'm curious real quick, and this is a kind of a question for both of you in different parts. I'm curious on the distinction, Ricky, that you found, like how is drag, what's the distinction between drag and ballroom? What's the connection? Where do the people agree? Where do they differ? And I'm also curious about your experience, Ebony, in terms of like, I don't know if you've been in both those worlds, but what, you know, what's the difference? What's the similarity? Where do they connect? Where do they differ? I'm just kidding. And also the, like, does the history, I know you talked about balls going back to like the 40s or earlier, and I'm curious, you know, which of those things came first if they didn't come out together.
But what I know, like the person that started like ballroom from what we know is Crystal LaVeja, who was doing like drag competitions in New York for like, you know, Andy Warhol and like the Tastemakers of New York City. But like the drag scene in New York was also, you know, really popular because it's, yeah, it's New York, but like it was very white. And that was her escape from that. And she started the ballroom scene, which originally was mostly like drag, but it was like drag houses. So, you know, and of course, I believe that it got departed because ballroom became more of a different kind of an entity in itself, where drag, in a sense, was still, you know, a departure, especially when it came to like non-Black people doing their own thing. Because you had like camp, you had like other forms of drag that's nowhere connected with the ballroom scene at all. Two separate worlds. Even I believe with like the drags category and ballroom is not the drag you'll see on stage.
That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, there's a lot of like trans amazing Black trans performers who do drag performances and shows. There's also in the ballroom scene, but it's similar, but it's, I don't think it's the same.
Yeah, there's like there's so many ways to like categorize it, but it's like,
yeah,
you know, there's that Venn diagram we were talking about before. A square and a rectangle, it's like one is one but not always like it's like, but it's the same world. And like, you know, maybe there's a family tree someone can figure out. But what's interesting about that Crystal LaBeija moment is it started from a drag, like that it, the genesis of ballroom came out of a drag pageant, right? So like so it can't be, they can't be extracted from one another. But one thing that I thought about when you were just sort of talking is that, you know, drag is sort of this heightened, like this hyperbolic example of not necessarily but usually femininity. And then ballroom just gets so specific. Like, you know, the difference between doing a drag brunch and walking realness. Like technically those are both drag in a performative sense, but they're just on the opposite ends of the spectrum, you know? But then cut to Drag Race and everybody's doing a spin and dip now. Like everybody is on the floor, like spinning and doing the, for the lack of a better term, shablam. And what people call a death drop, but Ballroom is not here for that. So I will not be quoted as that, but I am using it as an example. I'm paraphrasing, folks, right? Because it's called a spin and dip because it's five parts of a technique, and it's which, you know, the elements of voguing, spins and dips, floor work, hands, duck walk, runway, right? Or catwalk, right? So those are the five elements. And so folks feel like it sort of minimizes spins and dips to a death drop. They don't like that language. But, you know, and I agree. Although, if we did sign up for that language, it is sort of really symbolically indicative of what it even is, getting down and getting back up, right? That whole sort of my gay father from Ballroom, who is the head of the House of Masai Margiela, he talks about it being a resurrection, right? How, you know, folks of color, queer folks are constantly asked to sort of relent, or to persevere in the face of sort of death every day. And so, you know, whether that be sort of like the AIDS crisis that sort of improportionately affected us, or, you know, transitioning, that is a type of sort of death. So we're in close proximity to that idea. And so that dance is sort of a symbolism of getting down and getting back up again. I just went off tangent on that. Drag. So there's a whole theology that makes house music gospel, the MC, the pastor, like there's a whole thing, right? Everyone on the floor of the congregation, like we can go there, but drag. So Crystal LaBeija at the, I think it was Miss Camp 1967, 68. I always get the year mixed up because the film is marked as a year, but the title was a different, it was the year before or year after, right? Year before, but it happened during the making of The Queen. So even those two documentaries, The Queen and Paris is Burning, are inextricable from one another, because The Queen is a drag pageant, the document of a drag pageant, and it just so happened that the climax ended up being the genesis, the spark point of Ballroom, the house ballroom system, Crystal LaBeija leaving and being like, I'm tired of these white people not giving me a sash or a trophy when I know I look better than a list of people, but especially Harlow, right? Because she said what, her hair was a mess, look at her. And what's funny, so Philly, you know, even though, you know, you were sort of saying that like it's not as big in terms of pop culture maybe as California and New York, the three biggest cities for drag continue to be New York, obviously, Atlanta because of the huge Black gay population, and then Philadelphia because so Phil Black, who is a famous cross-dresser and in entertainment, I want to say at the turn of the century, just he was in Jet Magazine, like people, like he had the niche, like that corner of entertainment was his. He's from Philly and he's in The Queen. You can hear him in the background talking to folks. Dorian Corey is on the casting sheet for The Queen and is in the background when Crystal LaBeija is going off. Flawless Sabrina, the host of that pageant. Yeah, Mother Sabrina was like, you're showing your color, which is a real sort of radio timing kind of adjective, right? You're just showing your color. Dorian Corey's like, don't tell her she's showing her color. You don't understand the implications of such language, is what she implied. She has a right to show her color, is what she says. So they can't, they're just there. They're just like this. And so sometimes ballroom shows up in pageantry, and sometimes pageantry is ballroom because of just walking a category, right? And being judged. It's an intrinsic part to it. So they aren't the same thing, but they are close cousins, first cousins, or twins that live life differently. I don't know. It's hard to say what the proper metaphor is, but you know, different but the same, for sure. I think Fall of Sabrina is from Philly too, and brought it. So there's Philly's like huge. My gay father's from Philly. I just interviewed someone named Odu Odenamu who was in the Baltimore.
So I'm not going to say that Philly isn't famous or known, but like there is still a level of like underdog and like a little bit of underdog. There's a little bit.
And the standard of living a drag queen might get in Philly might be a lot less than LA or New York, right? Like, that's what we were talking about it before anyway. So, but yeah, Philly is bigger than the girls might think. That's
absolutely. I'm curious, Ebony, in terms of your identity, how has that changed or been formed, or what's the relationship to your identity and your performance or your drag name?
For complete context, when I started in Philadelphia, it was like kind of a little bit different. The drag scene was very gatekeeping, and it was the producers were ran by producers of shows, a lot of the drag producers and management and everything, et cetera, were mostly cis white. My generation kind of came up as, because like the standard of drag was just very traditional. Like you either were like, you know, a pretty girl or a camp. Philly was mostly camp. I kind of came in as more of an all-encompassing like gender, fuck, you know, your ideas, standards of gender. I'm just going to do me. And my influences was more so of a mixed bag of some sorts. And there wasn't anything like that in Philadelphia. So as time came along, I didn't really find a place for me in any of these spaces. So I started creating my own spaces in the city and kind of found people that are like-minded, and the community has grown. And people started getting tired of the mistreatment of Black, non-binary, and trans folks in these neighborhood spaces. And, you know, people started calling that shit out online. And it led from that to a clip being leaked by a former bar owner here in Philadelphia saying the N-word. Then myself and other people have boycotted and left. And with that, more Black and brown spaces have been curated and created, and more drag scenes and burlesque scenes have been made, curated, and broken off. And we have reached the point where there is a lot of us in the community that have created these new spaces, but still have not gotten the respect and treatment and money that other mainstream white drag performers are getting compared to us. So
I thought you started Freaking Queer, correct? That was your...
Yeah. Freaking Queer was like back in 2012, which is like an arts and music like festival. In 2020, during the pandemic, a lot of drag performers, including Black performers, my friend, my drag sister, Sardonyx, kind of started making lives about how Black performers, including themselves, were being discriminated against and all these microaggressions that's been happening. So Ben Chell started the Black Diaries, where we would go online on live and talk about our experiences in the drag world, which kind of put a lens on a lot of shit that people didn't know about, and people started getting called out and mad. So Chicago had a Black town hall, a Black performance town hall, which notably had Davidson, Shea Coulee, and other people from Drag Race talking about their experiences with like really big drag producers in Philadelphia, including tokenism and making them do all kinds of racist shit. So we were like, we're going to do this. So myself and Ben Chell did the Black town hall here. And we had a list of demands that includes like some producers step down because they have been gotten away with doing a lot of racism, microaggressions towards Black performers, underpaying, tokenism, sexual assault and harassment, et cetera, et cetera. And we made a whole slew of people step down. And we were like, for cast, we expect, you know, show cast to be at least 50% POC. And, you know, people have followed through with that. And more Black performers, such as myself and Vincel and other people, are now producers of shows and bars and different places. But will I say that it's perfect? No. There are still people on their bullshit. Still have to call people out. But it's a whole different world than what it used to be. But we definitely had to fight for years to finally get to a place to where we are now. I keep going to these spaces and getting disrespected. And I'm like, why? Like, and then there's people that are like, well, you know, I got to do what I got to do because, you know, I'm trying to make it.
You know what? That reminds me of that this quote from Toni Morrison that is in her, that documentary about her, but it's with her being interviewed by Charlie Rose, which is a whole nother thing. But I show it to my students because it talks about racism. And of course, in every interview, some white person is coming to her to answer what racism is. And she's like, it's your problem, right? But in the center of it, she goes, if in order to be tall, you have to stand on someone. If in order to be tall, you have to stand on someone else, you have a serious problem. And so if their economic sort of autonomy or whatever is built on your oppression, then that needs to fall, right? Like that's not them actually thriving. It's not actually thriving if it's on the backs of someone else.
Mm-hmm. One of the main points of the book of how does this all work with identity and what does that mean and who am I and, you know, who am I here? And to me, that's interesting to kind of get into.
I guess, like, I know I identify as non-binary, trans, femme-leaning, and my drag kind of is influenced by that because, like, I love and I embrace femininity, but I still don't believe in the the patriarchal point of view of what being feminine is. But I do appreciate all sorts of femininity, and that is influenced by my drag and my like performance and stuff. One of my biggest inspirations have always been femme queens of the ballroom community, but also my inspirations come from people like Grace Jones, Devin Avions, you know, other people that have taken like expression and androgyny and took it to their own level. All of that encompasses who I am as me, who I am.
Grace Jones, I'm so glad she's getting her flowers and is alive.
Okay, yes.
There was one week during the pandemic with like that for some reason I saw a boomerang 3 times in a week. And the fourth time I protested, I actually went back into my bedroom. I was like, I can't do it. But on the third time, I was like, she is phenomenal. Slash, when I was a child, she scared the shit out of me, as she should. You know what I mean? She's so wonderful.
Was it just her in a certain part, or was it her,
She seemed so intense. And then in that film, she had a French accent. So I didn't know until I was a teenager, she wasn't some French woman who was obsessed with S&M and wanted her perfume to smell good. But like, you know, like she played a similar role, funny enough, to Eartha Kitt, just like overt sexuality, you know what I mean? And demanding it. Eddie Murphy wrote those roles in reverse, and it was really breakthrough because of Grace Jones's androgyny for one, and for two, Eartha Kitt's age, and they were viable sexual exploits that held the power in that. They were the tops in those two situations, in that film. But anyway, I'm going off about Grace Jones. What are we talking about? Identity.
Grace Jones should be known by everybody. I mean, there is nobody in terms of. In my understanding, and I also didn't ever realize how amazing her music was until I just got into it. It's fucking amazing.
So many layers, actress, just a queer icon. Her brother was gay, evidently, and she's from Jamaica. She's Jamaican, and so they're super close. I've heard her say, and he was gay in Jamaica. So she grew up in her house, so she automatically had a sense of responsibility for the gay community. In a very ostracizing context. So of course she's a queer icon, but you know, cut to today, And Beyonce's talking about her. She did a song on her album. Yeah, it's just been an interesting, and she won't stop performing, which is thank God. I still need to see her. Like, it's just, so yeah, it's a Grace Jones Renaissance for sure, for sure. But identity, so I'll talk about my, but I have a question for you, afterwards, Ebony. So identity, you know, I kind of identify as a dancer, like one, I'm not a professional dancer. I'm a writer through and through, but on the list of things that I need to do to make myself, to support my wellness, dancing is up there. It's one of them. And so that's what really, I mean, ballroom in general got me to Vogueology as a class, but what really got me there was the fact that I was going to learn how to Vogue. And I think that speaks for a lot of people who find ball culture. And that's sort of what maintains the whole thing is my love of dancing and movement and that expression, being allowed to express it more freely, that femininity in my dance. Because you know, my proficiency is in hip hop dance, which skews a little male. But there's some modern that I do, and then you know, the dance that I know the most, the choreography I know the most is from Janet Jackson's The Pleasure Principle video, and that is fish all day. Like, that's the cuntiest thing you could possibly do outside of, you know.
What does fish all day mean, real quick? What is that expression?
Oh, cunty, it just means you're, it's like very femme, super sweet.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah,
Thank you. Sorry.
she's all fish. Like, that's just very feminine, very girly. And so that was, you know, the only time I've ever dressed in drag was to be Janet Jackson from the Pleasure Principle video. Actually, as a matter of fact, I almost wore that t-shirt today, was in the hamper. But I dressed in drag for my Halloween party and then performed Pleasure Principle at the end of the at midnight. So anyway, so I wanted the freedom to be able to do that. And up into, like, I lived in Boston for 10 years, and before I moved here and for school, to finish up school at the new school and took Vogueology, I'd been just sort of imbuing my life with more dance. And so and realizing that, like, I can do feminine choreography and that doesn't, it does, like, this, not the, I'm not going to die. I actually might thrive because of it. And so ballroom helped me with that, helped me just to find my inner cuntiness in terms of movement. Now cut to today, and it's been 12 years since I took that class, and I am not voguing the way I should be, but also I don't have to be. My day job is writing. I don't have to do anything but that. But there's part of me now that I have so much access to different Vogue instructors. I kind of want to get back into it, but Vogue Femme isn't where I would want to go. I want to go old way. Old way of voguing is your Willy Ninjas. It's your tell using that hands part, one that 1/5 hands of the elements of Vogue. It's telling a story with your, it's a narrative based, it's narrative based. And so that's the one that really draws me. Old way, new way is contortionism. So you got to be double jointed to do that. I am not. And then Vogue Femme is the one that you see around the world today, where it's, you know, people spinning, dipping. Laomi did that. It's just the, you know, it's acrobatics, and I got 41-year-old knees, so I can't be doing that. So I'm looking around at folks who are teaching old way, and one of them is the guy Jason Rodriguez from Pose. He was one of Electra Abundance's children, and I might start taking a class with him. I feel like it's one of those things where if I mention it enough in interviews, someone's gonna hold me accountable for it and be like, have you taken that class yet? And then I'll have to take it. So I want to up the, my game as a ballroom dancer, but for the time being, I'm a ballroom writer.
Could we? I want to go into pose. If you want to ask me something, I could wait. But I'd love to segue into pose because it seemed like, at least from the book, that you really feel like they did that right. I mean, it seemed to go off the rails at some point, but it seemed like they put all the conditions in to make it as authentic and real as it was. But then it seemed to go off maybe at the end. Something there was something you referenced at the end there where they seemed to make a left a odd turn. But in both of your experiences in watching pose and knowing about pose, what has that done? What does that change or not change? How is that influenced?
Yeah, it's really, all of the things are complicated. Good and bad are hard to qualify, but better is easier to qualify. And so I know that Pose did a better job than Madonna owning in the popular culture Vogue, right? Like, I know it's different. You know, Madonna hired some folks from the ballroom community, including Jose Extravaganza, to be part of her dancers. But like all of them ended up suing her at some point. Now they all love her again. So it's just sort of this, and it's just sort of this cycle of capitalism, but also they're friends, you know, so you can't dictate someone's experience. But I know things are getting better. But they have space to grow. So in the case of Pose, Ryan Murphy actually hired folks from the ballroom community to be part of the creative process. Trans folks haven't been represented like that on television ever. Trans folks of color had never been. He had people choreographing, but also writing and supervising, producing. I mean, Janet Mock directed. She's not ballroom, but, you know, we're getting there. But, you know, there's a void right now for ballroom documentaries that have the same sort of level of Paris is Burning. It just doesn't exist. And we're sort of waiting around for that to happen. I've been approached by production companies to do the book, and I've wrote it in a way where it can work as a docuseries. You know, every chapter could just be, it's already got the categories there. They don't have to figure that out. But my demand is that if somebody gives us the green light, my ballroom family, a lot of folks who have actually worked on Pose will not be consultants like they were on Pose, i.e. they get paid, they're contractors, they get paid for one time, and then after that, never again. They will come on from the ground up as producers on my series, if that ever happens. So it's increments, you know. Madonna only had a choreographer. Ryan Murphy had consultants. I'm going to have owners of their story in my thing if it happens. So
when I read the book, it was clear that it would thinking about the structure of the book, it was clear it would have made a really good documentary. I was envisioning it as a documentary in my head when I was reading.
From your mouth, God to yours. But I think what you were talking about with Pose is that they did in the last season an episode about Madonna's Vogue. Like, it peaked at 1990. Like, the first episode was 1990, and when it, and it was a good representation, although they led with the easiest foot, which was, oh, Madonna put us on, we're going to be big now, right? And so in drama, that's, you're just waiting for the other shoe to drop. So that ended up happening, you know. They're like, oh, nothing's changed, things have gotten worse, people know about us, but it's not all that different. But it was a good representation, because if you talk to people from ballroom, half of them are like, that bitch, and the other half are like, thank God. So what are you gonna do, you know? That's the thesis of the book. It's complicated. there's no right or wrong, good or bad. It's just very complicated, like life is. But I love Pose. I have a friend. He and I used to watch it every week, and he would come to me at the end and be like, that was a good episode, but this show might be bad. And I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, it's just like, it's kind of, some of the acting is bad, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, how much bad straight white shit have you watched? How many horrible soap operas? Like, this is, at worst, you can call this a telenovela, and that is amazing. And even in that context, you've never seen it look like us. So calm down and keep watching it. I'll see you next week. Like, that's kind of...
People came up to Ryan Murphy, and I'm like, Ryan Murphy's the last fucking... Maybe another project, but overall, Ryan Murphy's not the person to go after for representation, in my opinion. Maybe he fucked up in other projects. Maybe it wasn't about that one, but you got to give a person a break. But go on, I'm sorry.
I think he tried. It's hard to be the first of anything, but the girls, like, the folks from Ballroom definitely let him know. And there's room to grow, so I can't wait till that happens.
Yeah.
Well, you kind of alluded to it, Ebony, when we were doing intros, but talking about if you are comfortable talking about it, just sort of what it did for your drag did for your non-binary identity, like, you know, what, like, in a drag show, what about that carried into your everyday life that might have helped you?
I kind of came into my identity around the same time. And well, I think what it did was I kind of stopped being afraid and stopped being ashamed of who I am and how I presented myself to the world, which may seem unconventional to people. It's unconventional to the people in the community. It's unconventional to people outside of the community. So I'm just like, why am I going to sit up here and going to work so hard to try to hide and be different, where it's kind of like, oh, I'm not going to be accepted anywhere I stand anyway. I might as well stand on my 2 feet and just be who I am and wait for the rest of the world to catch up. So, you know, and thankfully, it has. People have, you know, there is a lot of, and I'm looking at Gen Z, there is a lot of people now that are, it's everything is kind of a mixed bag. It's not a box that you can put a lot of people in. And that's what makes it like amazing, because was any of this stuff normal to people back then? No. Whether it was drag, whether it's ballroom, whether it's anything, this was not necessarily normal, like, to the everyday people. So, if anything, my idea through my identity and through performance is to kind of be, it's like activism in the form of performance. Because some of my performances have included like social political shit. I've done like protest performances on stage, talking about people in the community. I've done like marches, you know, and drag. And for me, it's like, it's a statement for me. It's a statement for myself, but it's a statement for other people who are trying to be themselves, but are afraid to.
It's nice that when your work can be the platform for just creativity, but then also your politics and a witness for someone else. You know, I keep trying to bring that feeling of being in the dance studio or being at a ball into the world with me, because I'm a writer. Like, I thrive at parties. I'm good on a podcast, but when I, like, most of the time I just want to be left alone and or just observe without being witnessed. And so I'm really, really, really trying to like work on pulling that audacity out of the page and into like me going to a coffee shop, you know. It's harder than you would think, but it's easy to just compartmentalize it. Like, I can be, you know, Ricky Malcolm X Jr. on the page, and then, you know, someone says something out in public and I'm like, oh god, I gotta say something. Here I go, you know. But it's a good tool. It's a good point of reference to get there.
Okay. Sometimes you just want to exist.
Yeah. Sometimes you want to just be part, but some of that is activist, like or radical, wanting to just be who you are in a space and not have to be active in that.
Mm-hmm. Because I'm not necessarily wearing heels and purple eyeshadow to go to acne, you know, but I'm just me.
Although, if you did, I would say you look great. But
I'll come take photos of that any day. Yeah. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, but that's so to that point, identity point in the book, I talked to, do you know Gia Love, you know, of her?
I love Gia Love.
Gia Love is in the book. She's one of the people I interviewed. She's the best. But when I interviewed her, you know, I was like, well, what do you, because there's a chapter called body, there's body and there's realness, you know, the categories, but then also socio-political sort of topics. I talked to her about both of those. But in realness, you know, I was like, well, what do you want folks to know? Because she's one of my two trans girls who walked realness in the past, but also are activists, you know. I was like, well, what do you want people to know? And she was like, that I just have joy, that like I, you know, I like the entirety of my story is not prep. Like, you know, like I want to, and she was like, I used to debate in high school and I'm a really, really good debater. And she also told me that her final debate, she won it and she did an interpretation of her argument by voguing it at the very end and she won. And so the two aren't exclusive, but, and that she's a tennis player, that she loves playing tennis, which people wouldn't know about her. So I think, you know, there's like a gradient where it's like our plight, our joy, and then can we just be, like, can we just Like, do I have to be Black and excellent all the time? Like, it's one of those. Like, intersectionality can be exhausting sometimes, actually.
The work can be exhausting.
I love where this is going. I want to continue this. I want to really get into who, you know, who are your mentors? Who are your heroes? Who are your teachers? Who has given you the love enough to make you want to be talking about this stuff and being part of it?
Okay. My influences. I have a lot. I spoke on a little bit earlier, like Kavi Amiens, Grace Jones are big inspirations. Janet Jackson is a big inspiration because her music, especially the Velvet Rope, has all is just, you know, I hold on to the meaning of Sankofa very dearly in my heart. Also, I am a love house music. You was talking about like house music being gospel. I have a show that I do every year that's based in house music because I believe it's like music gospel for the fallen and for the okay.
I'll put a citation, but I'm gonna say that.
Yes.
You mentioned that idea in the book. Somewhere you talk about how it's church for people.
Yeah, there's a chapter called Church. Yeah, and it's just a running big ass metaphor for ballroom as church, including a whole section about music and how it's the gospel. And actually, you know, there's a lot of music in this book, and I love music. Low key snuck a lot into the book, and ended up getting this book is one of Pitchfork's best music books of 2020. Wow.
Holy
like
shit.
I wouldn't even try and it. Like it just like because they're so getting our culture, our community, our culture loves music, and we you can't take it out. It's just such a part. Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh no. Yours is adding to it. Absolutely. That's why I'm so connected to it because like there's music that moves me. I love all kinds of music, but there's something about house music that like. It's unapologetically queer, and it is literally like the most diverse kinds of like genres ever. Like you can dig so deep. I go on a YouTube poll for hours and listen to Frankie Knuckles mixes and David Morales and CJ McIntosh and Bastards at Work and all kinds of stuff that's just sent me into a whole like warp of everything.
Yeah, I mean Masters of Work, they had a 25 year anniversary like album, like a compilation, changed my life. And it's that moment where disco was just transitioning into house, and yeah, you couldn't get any gayer than that compilation.
Absolutely.
Role models, mentors, were you done? No, I was asking Ebony if you were all set.
That's pretty much it for me. I have a whole list. Mm-hmm. But yeah, those are like a lot of the big ones for me.
That you're bringing up. What are younger people? What are some people that are younger you're bringing up that you're impressed by? And then we'll go. And then Ricky, feel free to just go off.
For right now, the younger people, I'm influenced by the people that are around me, my drag children, my the new generation. Of like amazing trans and non-binary folks that are just shaping the world for what it is now.
Are you comfortable sharing one person you're championing these days, or does that cause more problems for your other kids that aren't being mentioned? I know that I'm in a Jewish family. I know all this works. I gotcha. That's why I asked that question. No, but that's fair. Yeah, but they're cool. Yeah. All right, sorry.
Janet from the start. I mean, my mom was convinced I was straight for a good amount of time because I had so many Janet pictures on my wall. No, that's just a calling card of a gay. So Janet for sure, the way she moves. The two folks that I met in Vogology, Michael Robertson and Robert Simber, who I call my two gay dads. They came at a time where my real father was just being the pinnacle of the asshole that he is. And they came in and I became inheritor to a scholarship now. Like I'm doing this because they taught me Michael and Robert, for sure. And they're, you know, theologians, they're artists, but they're also ballroom community leaders. So they're perfect. I lost one, got two. So that's good. Janet, Toni Morrison, I mentioned. Like, I don't read, I mean, I love everything she writes. I haven't read a lot of her fiction, but her nonfiction as an essay writer is what really gets me. Like the profundity of just hearing her talk about the world that we actually live in a way, breakthrough. I mean, I saw that documentary that I referenced earlier. I can't remember the name of it. It's the pieces that I am, the parts that I am. And I was in a flight and I can't even remember where I was going, but I will never forget hearing her explain racism in the way in which she did. She's like, she called it a profound neurosis and nobody sees it for what it actually is. And that part about if you have to stand on someone else to be tall, like it was like a relief. Every time I read her, it's a relief to hear what I can't articulate. Lynn Tillman was my thesis advisor. She's a downtown New York writer and a friend of mine. I took a class with her and just never left. She's just such a wonderful, sort of sharp downtown writing woman. And I'm gonna leave it at that. Oh, you know what? I keep wanting to write him a letter and I haven't, so I'll do it here. Mr. Toms, my kindergarten teacher. This man, but first of all, my first teacher ever, and a Black man, a young Black man, was my kindergarten teacher. That is phenomenal because a gay Black man, the first time I had a gay Black teacher was in that vocology class as like a 29-year-old, you know? So the time in between those where it was someone in my life that looked like me at least, was at least 25 years. Crazy. It's crazy. So we need more Black teachers. But Mr. Toms used to play You Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog on the guitar and have us dance around like crazy. He used to have us meditate before I knew what meditation was. He used to call me, a 5-year-old, Dr. Ricky Tucker, MD. Do you know what kind of impression that leaves on a child? Like, I'm not going to be a medical doctor, but I probably will get my PhD at some point just because I know that I can, because that man used to put it in my name every day.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so I want to write him a letter before he leaves this earth. I need to keep doing it, but that's my love letter to him. So that's it.
Yeah. I want to thank you so much for trusting in me. But I really, it was a pleasure. I feel like it's really nice watching the two of you connect. It was really, really, really lovely having both of you here. You know, this is what I've been trying to do, but it's tricky. Like, you always, you know, even being an ally, you sometimes get attacked for that.
Sure.
So sometimes you can't win. I had somebody one day, oh, you know, I love what you're doing. Oh, you must be a queer Black person. And I'm like, and they were like, hey, you know, you might, I'm like, you know, and in one moment they were like, and I mean, I kind of am, to be honest. I'm to a certain extent in my spirit and soul. And they like offered me to do a website. And then when I told them, I'm sorry, I don't, and that's not who I am. I'm a white Jewish person. They're like, oh, and they got mad at me.
Oh, you.
And again, look, yeah. I mean, I don't have it worse than anybody else, but it's tricky sometimes to try to do the right thing. And then when you meet the assholes in the world that are involved, they fuck with your shit. So it's always, I'm very careful about who I get involved with. And I'm very glad that whatever I did in the world, I got to both of you, because it's just very enjoyable. I was in the fields, we'll say. And I just really grateful that it landed on you both, meeting each other and connecting and having this discussion. Because, you know, I'm up. I mean, again, I'm also in terms of content, I was obsessed with Pose. I mean, I don't think there's any documentary I've watched more than Barris is Burning. I really like The Queen when I watch it. I never watched the end. And I'm glad you made it at a point in your book. Is that end of that? Has anyone ever parried? The people have
Drag Race. So they do the snatch game on Drag Race. I can't remember who did it, but there was a winning performance of Crystal LaBeija. And I talk about it in the book too, because it kind of lifts. She just, it's funny, it's hilarious, the snatch game is fun, but it just makes Crystal seem like she was just mad. But she had a political point, you know, like, so she's a caricature in pop culture, but it was a protest, is what that was.
And I hadn't realized I didn't realize who they were in Paris is Burning until I just looked them up visually, and it made a lot of sense.
Yeah. They're like we were talking about, they're just all so interswirled. Yeah, it's hard to even say who came from when. And actually, you know, just to put something in real quick, you know, the research goes back now. My friend Channing is working on a book about William Dorsey Swan, who was
first
a formerly enslaved person who first held drag balls down.
Yeah, in his- I did a like little class mentioning William Dorsey. Yeah, a really important person.
It's like the more history we get, the more we think, oh, it was drag first. No, it was ball. You know, like it's just it's and we're gonna come to find out, which I wanted to say earlier too, Ebony, is that like, you know, non-conforming, non-binary folks have existed throughout history. It's just sort of you know, we know that, but the world doesn't know that. So it's just a series of forgetting it all the time. And it sucks to have to be constantly protesting that, you know, what we know, that we know is natural.
Exactly.
Do both of you find, have both of you found in this world that you just want to scream and rip people's heads off, but you choose not to? Is it hard to bite your tongue having gone through all this shit, knowing this history? Is it hard to kind of be in these worlds with having to fight without pulling out a knife? You know what I mean? I don't mean actually putting on a knife, but you know what I'm saying? Like, does it ever just get to you where you're like, I'm going to fucking kill one of you?
Yeah. I mean, you know, whiteness is that's a full-time job in this context, but I was walking to an administrative office down the street from me. I like Googled where they were and I was like, oh, it's two blocks down. I walked down there and there are two guys working construction and a third guy who's like their friend, but definitely loitering. Like he's just hanging out while they actually work. And I walk by and he looks at me and he goes, queer. And then like, I keep walking. I just go, so I yell, so what? It's like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I get to that administrative office like 2 minutes later and the guy's walking out and he goes, oh, we close at 4. And then I was just like pissed because now I got to turn right back around and walk back by those guys. And I was just like, I snapped. I was like, I had to walk down here for no reason. And some, I got like tiny hate crimed. I was like, which one of you assholes said queer when I walked by? They all denied it, but the little guy who did it got real mad about it and got up in my face. And then I didn't budge. I was just like, you're only proving my point. You definitely said it. And my final point was, so, and he was doing the thing where he pretends to want to fight and have his friend pull him off, but I'm just standing there and nothing actually happened. But I said to him, and my parting words were to him, and beep this out if you need to. I just go, you're going to say that another time and someone else is going to fuck you up. And I just walked off and went, because also I'm a month coming off of O'Shea Sibley and like that whole thing. In New York City, someone needs to point out that I have sex with men. Grow up, dude. Like, grow up. And also, why does that fascinate you? And also, he had one of those like face piercings with a diamond on it. I was like, you're queer. Past middle school, I'm tired of that shit. And if you catch me on the wrong day, I'm going to say something. Especially after someone voguing in public warranted their murder.
Hey, thanks so much for checking this out. We've got some amazing episodes coming up. Just going to preview a few. We got to talk to a really sweetheart of a person, Drew Powell, actor, musician. We got into the strike, into his work. I'm glad I can put it out. I wasn't able to put out a lot of these for a while. We will be speaking with Crispin Glover when his new film comes out somewhere later in the year. Hugely excited about that. I'm such a fan of his films, the ones he directs and he tours with. It's amazing stuff. I went to Comic-Con this year and covered it. We're going to be putting an episode on just a lot of people I talked to that were there for different purposes. Really got to meet amazing people there. We'll be speaking about Patrick D. Pagnagno through his nephew, about his photography. Jelly Boy the Clown is a really amazing sideshow performer out of Philadelphia. Michael Weinstein, photographer. Ruth Ann Freeman, musician, wrote the song Windy, has a really great story as well. A few more I'll just mention. Black Virgin Improv Show, which is out of California. Rich Lemon does something called Program 4, which is really amazing. We just spoke with Isis Aquarian. If you had seen the documentary Source Family, she was the main archivist and matriarch of that community. And what a lovely person to talk to. We spoke with Josie Cotton recently. We got a bunch more to record. One more I'm excited about is Taylor Mack, drag performer, and he's going to have a co-host, Earl Dax, who I've known, who's been behind the scenes in drag performances and shows for many years. So come back, man. We got some good stuff coming on. We could really use people to spread the word. We don't have the money to pay for advertising. Our Instagram is our biggest asset, and we've got over 45,000 followers, but they limit all of our posts on the podcast, which really sucks. So please spread the word. It is, you know, even outside of me doing it, it's a really interesting podcast. It's very diverse, really unique stories. It's based on outsiders and underdogs, people that, you know, didn't make it the traditional way or did something very different. Just people that, you know, I find to have unique stories and kind of live these lives for themselves, sometimes looking for fame, mostly just trying to be who they were. So it's been the best thing in my life. And these people are way, again, above my pay grade. And it's a joy and an honor. And I have such gratitude to get to do this. So please check it out and share. Thank you. We thought in different ways.